Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
When I ran away from home, I did it more from duty than desire. My mother and I didn't see enough of each other to have really fallen out. She'd wake me each morning as she went to work, and by the time I got home from school, she'd usually be asleep on the sofa. We'd eat something on toast for tea, and then cuddle up to watch Panorama. Whatever they were discussing, my mother would wait for her moment, turn to me, and in credulity tightening her voice, cry out, "You see, capitalism doesn't work." I was 14 years old, and had started to ask myself some difficult questions. What was I doing with my life? Was passing my O-levels in Spanish and history the limit of my ambitions? Did any of the artists and writers that I admired care about the Treaty of Utrecht or the chief exports of Chile? It seemed to me that I was wasting my time. I'd be 16 soon enough, and that meant time was running out. I wondered whether I shouldn't be the assistant cook on a tramp steamer by now. Were tramp steamers still a thing, I asked myself? And if they were, how did one go about getting a job on one? I could cook cheese on toast and spaghetti bolognese, but it occurred to me I might need to widen my culinary repertoire to get through a transatlantic voyage. The other problem was that I'd only been on two boats so far. One was a ferry to Ireland, and I had no idea where it had sailed from, and the other was a riverboat taking tourists up and down the Thames. Would my hands become calloused and my face sufficiently weathered by the wind as we worked the uncertain waters between Hampton Court and the Greenwich Observatory? I also had to admit that an important part of my calling was the need to impress my classmates. Where has he gone, they were supposed to wonder. What new thrills is he enjoying without us? For this to work, surely the first requirement was distance. I needed to be far away, dealing with a language none of them could speak, and spending my days with a cast of exotic women and desperate men. The people who worked the river seemed more bored than anguished, and the effect of my absence would almost certainly be reduced by the chances of bumping into my schoolmates on the tube. So one Saturday morning, I got some money out of the post office and took a 3-hour bus journey to a university town that I'd visited once with my brother. There was a market there, I remembered, with a very impressive second-hand record store, and, what looked to my eyes, like an all-night laundrette. What more did I need? I thought that I would find a job easily enough. Probably not on a boat, but reviewing live bands, perhaps, for the local paper, or ghostwriting the memoirs of some half-forgotten celebrity. I ate a Cornish pasty as I walked round the market, and as the light began to fade, sat in the laundrette and waited. If nothing happened, I thought, I could sleep there, soaking up the heat from the huge tumble dryers. But before it came to that, I was sure I would meet a friendly face. An art student, maybe. Or an unpublished poet. She'd ask me back to her bedsit, where we'd drink red wine, and then chastely curl up in her bed, she seeking company, and me wanting nothing more than warmth. In the morning we'd get bacon sandwiches, and she could introduce me to her friends, who would surely be thrilled to discover that an unqualified child with literary pretensions was now dependent on their charity. It was almost 5 o'clock when the woman who ran the laundrette introduced herself. "We're shutting in 10 minutes," she said, pointing to the machines. "Which one of these is yours?" "None," I said, standing up and immediately feeling the draught from outside. "I'm just waiting for a friend."
"Looks like you'll have to wait somewhere else, doesn't it?"
the woman went on, holding the door open. I got home at about 9 o'clock that night, to find my mother sitting at the kitchen table. She held up the note I'd left, saying that I would return when I was rich and famous. "Wow," she said, more impressed than I'd ever seen her. "That didn't take long."
"No," I shrugged. "Turns out it's easier than it looks.
The kettle just boiled if you want a cup of tea."
"Thanks.
But be quick. There's a documentary about the death of Nicholas and Alexandra on BBC Two. We don't want to miss that." I put a tea bag into a cup and wondered whether somewhere up north, a poetic woman, barely out of her teens, was loading the weekly wash into a tumble dryer. I crossed to the fridge as a sudden craving came over me.
Can I have a bacon sandwich? I called towards the living room. Of course, my mother replied. But only if it doesn't need bread. Or bacon. OK. But there's some cold lasagna in the fridge if you want it. Lovely, I replied. And it was.
We sailed on the ship John B., my grandfather and me. Around Nassau town we did roam, drinking all night, got into a fight. Well, I feel so homesick, I want to go home. So hoist up the John B. sail, see how the mainsail set.
When the first episode of the television series Murder, She Wrote aired, I felt instantly that Jessica Fletcher and I were kindred spirits. I wanted to be Jessica Fletcher, the attractive, intelligent, fictional mystery writer with a penchant for tripping over a murder wherever she went. She seemed to have such a glamorous life. Never short of an attractive male companion or a sharp instinct for the truth, Jessica Fletcher was beautifully played by Angela Lansbury. The programme was rather unusual at the time, as most of the lead characters in murder mysteries were either male or considerably younger. There was little violence, and it was reckoned to have one of the most popular theme tunes on television. Angela Bridget Lansbury was born into an illustrious family in London on the 16th of October in 1925. Her mother, Moina McGill, was an actress from Belfast. Her father, Edgar, was a socialist politician, as was her grandfather, George Lansbury, who later led the British Labour Party. Her father died when she was nine. "It took a lot out of me," she is quoted as saying. She lost interest in school and became something of a dreamer, lost in grief and more interested in acting. To escape the Blitz in 1940, her mother took the family to the United States without Angela's older half-sister Isolde, who had just married the young actor Peter Ustinov. Angela studied acting in New York, and in 1942, at 17, she moved to Hollywood, where shortly afterwards she got her first film roles in Gaslight and The Picture of Dorian Gray, earning her two Oscar nominations and a Golden Globe Award. She appeared in many more films for MGM, including National Velvet and The Harvey Girls. In 1962, she received widespread acclaim for her role in The Manchurian Candidate and was again nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. In 1966, she played the lead role in the Broadway musical Mame, earning her a myriad of awards. Despite being a growing part of Hollywood's elite, and now with a young family of her own, Angela Lansbury was never completely comfortable amid the Hollywood social scene. But she continued to win many more accolades and awards for her work, earning recognition on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. As an actress, singer and dancer, she worked with Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland and Elizabeth Taylor. However, it wasn't until 1984 when she starred as Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote, set in the fictional town of Cabot Cove, Maine, that she really became a household name. She had expressed an interest in television work and was already in discussions for a sitcom role elsewhere. But when the script for Murder, She Wrote came in, the role having already been turned down by Jean Stapleton and Doris Day, she liked the character of Jessica Fletcher. She recorded a pilot, it was picked up by the networks, and at 59 years old, she embarked on the role which would run for 12 years and make her a global star. Angela Lansbury brought likeability and style to the character, while at the same time paying homage to the more mature lady. In a fascinating public interview with Aideen Gormley in 2016, as part of the Dublin International Film Festival. She explained how she sought to shape Jessica's character as the series grew. Her clothes became more stylish, she became more outgoing, and she took a flat in New York. The New York flat helping the plausibility aspect of all those murders as the series progressed. When the series finished in 1996, she continued to make occasional appearances on stage and in films, and in 2014 she was made a dame by Queen Elizabeth II. Today she lives in California. She married her second husband, Peter Shaw, in 1949, and they were together for over 50 years until he died in 2003. She had two children, a son, Anthony, and a daughter, Deirdre. Her son later directed many episodes of Murder, She Wrote. She has always treasured her Irish roots, and she has been a regular visitor to East Cork since she and her husband bought an old farmhouse in the village of Conna in 1970. Their Malibu house had just been destroyed by fire, but they also wanted to get their teenage children away from California's drug culture. "It was a decision we never regretted," she said. "Ireland offered us a new life." In the 1990s, they built their own house in Ballycotton. She has spoken warmly of the easygoing pace of life in County Cork and the friendliness of the local people. "I still enjoy watching reruns of the programme. And should I ever get to revisit San Francisco, I will travel north among the vines and redwoods and visit the small coastal town of Mendocino, where they filmed the harbour shots and the outside of Jessica Fletcher's supposed house in Maine. They say you should never meet your heroes, and maybe they're right. But one way or another, Jessica Fletcher will always be my hero, thanks to the wonderful 95-year-old Hollywood royalty that is Angela Lansbury."
I've no idea what my 10-year-old self would make of what I have done with my life. Things have occurred, good and bad, that this shy boy could never have conceived of. Marriage, fatherhood, widowhood. A conventional working life that ended when, age 24, I began to eke out a living with just a thin sliver of my imagination. He might be surprised or bemused by my 15 novels produced since then. But what would truly astound and astonish him is that here I am with enough courage to speak on the radio. That 10-year-old was trapped inside the cage of a terrible stammer. A stammer is a prophecy in reverse, telling you what is going to happen long after it has already happened. For me, as a child, being afflicted with a stammer meant suffering daily public crucifixions. Supermarkets were a rarity. Grocery shops were kingdoms ruled by white-coated monarchs who leaned across counters to demand a password upon entry. The password was the name of whatever I was sent to purchase. Items I could see tantalisingly within reach on the shelves behind them, but their names might have been in Arabic for all the chance I had of pronouncing them. My panic at being sent on an errand began before I left the house and would crystallise into palpable terror when I entered the shop, because no matter how often I rehearsed a simple phrase like "a pint of milk, please," once I stood at the counter, I became tongue-tied, unable to speak. What I wanted became guesswork for shopkeepers. Most were kind, but others were gruff, making you feel they didn't suffer fools gladly And back then, possessing a stammer, you could be made to feel like the biggest fool alive. In films, stammerers were presented as figures of fun and mockery, but a stammer was no laughing matter. It respected neither creed nor class. It could afflict anyone, from a boy in Finglas to Britain's wartime reluctant monarch George VI, who strove to project a strong public image while privately fighting to control his stammer. No matter who you were, a stammer could strip away your self-confidence and make you socially isolated. My true poetry was being sent to buy a sachet of shampoo because I also suffered severe difficulties in pronouncing the S sound. Therefore, in 1969, when my mother began taking me to speech therapy sessions in Temple Street Children's Hospital, it seemed impossible that I could ever say the phrase my speech therapist patiently tried to teach me, 66 sneaky silvery snakes. Unbeknownst to me, my mother was seriously ill and died later that year. Some of my last memories of her involve us watching a blacksmith shoeing horses at Kelly's Row, a back lane into the hospital. Her concern for me, regarded as a dunce because of my stammer, was alleviated by my kindly therapist, who assured her he's actually a bright penny, but just under a cloud. 1969, when my mother took me to Temple Street, was an important year for speech therapy in Ireland because, for the first time, speech therapists began to be trained here. Until the pioneering group of 15 students started training that year, the few therapists who worked in Ireland were foreign or, if Irish, needed to train abroad. In 1971, there were 20 speech therapists in Ireland. Today, there are 1,800. None of the pioneers working in the Temple Street speech therapy unit will remember a small boy from Finglas being brought there in 1969, but tongue-tied children like myself have never forgotten the patient assistance we received in such institutions. I left Temple Street finally able to pronounce the S sound, but my stammer didn't disappear overnight. It took years, and occasionally I still get stuck on a word. When my mother died, worried for her son, she could never have envisaged how one day I would partly make my living giving public readings. I've lost count of the hundreds of times I've walked onto stages or into radio studios where often an engineer doing a sound check will ask me to say a few random words. My words are never random. Staring at the microphone, I remember my mother bringing me to Temple Street, the patient speech therapist helping me to gain the power of speech, and how some tongue-tied child might be half listening to the radio, wondering if they will ever escape the stammer that seems to weigh them down. Slowly and distinctively, to honour them all, I enunciate into the microphone, 66 sneaky silvery snakes.
Everybody's talking at me, I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare, I can't see their faces.
Along with mashed potato and butter, cabbage is the other important ingredient in Colcannon, a dish traditionally served in Ireland at Halloween. But it seems that in the past, cabbage had uses other than culinary at this time of year. The first time I heard of cabbage being used as part of Halloween celebrations was in the mid-60s, when our primary school teacher entertained us with stories of terrible happenings in the big bad world, otherwise known as Wexford Town. One afternoon, as we knitted and sewed in a most industrious fashion, Sister perched on one of the sixth class desks and told us of a lawless Halloween event that had taken place years before when she was a young teacher in the Fife. At the time, the townies didn't even give Halloween its proper title, preferring to call the ancient feast of All Souls Cabbage Stump Night. Gangs of young people, some of them girls, went round at nightfall banging on their neighbours' doors with the stalks of cabbages and causing untold damage to the nerves of honest citizens and the paintwork on their front doors. I couldn't imagine anyone venturing out on Halloween night. Everyone knew that the souls of the dead would be so thick on the ground that you would hear them crunch if you so much as stepped outside the door. So I was relieved when Sister said that in recent times the guards had put a stop to this ugly practice. I haven't heard Cabbage Stump Night mentioned since then, and I began to wonder if it was a figment of the good sister's imagination, caused perhaps by the culture shock of leaving the gentle hills of her native Kerry to walk among the untamed seafaring Wexfordians. So I looked up Cabbage Stump Night and found quite a few references in the Irish Folklore Archive. Set up in 1937 to gather information on traditions in Ireland, the decision to involve national school children was an inspired one, and over the next couple of years, the senior children in primary schools filled 140,000 copybooks with local history, ancient cures, proverbs and customs. Images of these copybooks can now be viewed online, and the click of a button brought me to the copies of the pupils from the school where our nun had worked. In impeccable cursive handwriting, three of the girls told how, while the mothers were busy making the coal cannon, the children saved the cabbage stalks. This would be their ammunition to terrorise the neighbours as soon as darkness fell. Madge Brown of Modlin Town noted that the fun began after the tea, when boys and girls gathered together in back places. They planned their route and set off striking doors with cabbage stumps, waking the babies and damaging doors. The victims did not take this lying down, and householders often stood behind the front door wielding a stick to hit their tormentors. Peggy Saunders of Burns Lane reported that women waited at upstairs windows with buckets of water to throw on the perpetrators. But the fun was not confined to Halloween night. Nan O'Brien of King Street recorded that on the night before Halloween, the young people staked out their route and went round hitting doors to see who would not tolerate their pranks. And these houses were their very first targets on Cabbage Stump Night, when the guards had to be called to chase off the delinquents. My online research yielded another interesting fact. In Framingham, Massachusetts, the eve of Halloween is known as Cabbage Night. Local historians blame this flinging about of cabbages on the Dutch settlers who were big fans of the leafy greens, and on Scottish immigrant girls who pulled cabbages from their neighbours' vegetable patches and examined the leaves to divine the qualities of their future husbands. Their fortune-telling completed, they flung the cabbages against the doors and ran away. The historians may be blaming the wrong nation, however, as back in the folklore archive, Peggy Mulligan from Cranford National School Gorey recorded that using cabbage to tell the future was an Irish custom. Sometimes a boy and girl go out in a field, she wrote, where they each pull a head of cabbage, and if there's clay on the roots, they will soon be married. But time moved on. Fashions changed, and we abandoned the old mischief-making pursuits of Samhain to embrace Hollywood's glitzy, sugar-filled reimagining of our ancient festival. And who would have thought, as we come to terms with our current restricted socialising, that we would crave a time when a knock on the door heralded some light-hearted fun, and when only trick-or-treaters wore masks?
Well, did you ever make a cannon made with lovely pickle cream, with the greens and scallions mingle like a picture in a dream? Did you ever make a hole on top to hold the melt and flake of the creamy flavoured butter that our mothers used to make? Oh, you did, so did he, and so did I. And the more I think about it, you're the nearer.
Neapolitan opera fans, hoping to hear Margaret Burke Sheridan sing on Monday, October the 25th in 1920, were disappointed. The performance is cancelled, a notice penned to the closed doors of the San Carlo Opera House declared. La prima donna cannot sing because her compatriot is dead. Her compatriot, Terence McSweeney, had earlier faded away after 74 days on hunger strike. The brains of the Republican Army in Ireland died in Brixton Prison this morning, headlined the New York Times. His status as Cork's Lord Mayor and an elected public representative ensured that his hunger strike had resounded across the international press like a tragic drama. A drama that echoed his own best-known play, The Revolutionist, but acted on the world stage before a universal audience. Terence McSweeney wrote prose, poetry and drama, and according to his friend Daniel Corkery, he loved literature and art with a passion almost as great as his passion for a free Ireland. His library was filled with Shaw and Ibsen and Moliere. He had copied his choice of Rossetti sonnets into a pocket notebook to be recited as he pushed his bicycle 20, 30, 40 miles away from his beloved wife to speak brave words in some little hamlet, then wake at dawn in a strange house to read his favourite poem, Shelley's I Arise from Dreams of Thee. His wife Muriel Murphy was daughter to one of Cork's wealthiest merchant princes, brewer of Murphy Stout. Her family, she said in her testimony to the Bureau of Military History, was unionist, imperialist, capitalist, conservative and Roman Catholic. Courtship with an impoverished Irish rebel was the last thing the family wanted, so her mother refused her permission to marry. This meant that if Muriel wished to inherit, she couldn't marry until she was 25. On June the 9th, 1917, the day after her 25th birthday, she and Terence McSweeney were married in the English town of Brumyard, where he was then interned. More than half of his life with Muriel would be spent behind bars. In 1918, he was in prison for two major events in his life, the birth of his daughter Moira and his election to the first Doyle. By 1920, Terence McSweeney and his comrade, Lord Mayor Tomás McCurtain, were the face of the Republican movement in Cork. McCurtain's callous murder by the RIC in front of his pregnant wife and children was a portent of terrible things to come, the arrival of the Black and Tans 5 days later. McSweeney's speech on his election to replace his friend as Lord Mayor contained his most famous principle. It is not those who can inflict the most, but those that endure the most who will conquer. Less than 5 months later, he was arrested in the City Hall. He refused food even before his court-martial, which took only 15 minutes to find him guilty of possessing seditious documents likely to cause disaffection to His Majesty. One of those documents was his own inauguration speech. Sentenced to 2 years in Brixton Prison, he responded, "I shall be free, alive or dead, within the month." Muriel remained at her husband's side throughout his hunger strike. At the time, it was believed that a person could not survive for longer than a month without solid food. The days passed into weeks, and filled with a foreboding, Muriel asked Michael Collins to intervene. Collins ordered McSweeney to end the strike, as he would, as Collins told him, be 10 times a greater asset to the movement alive than dead. McSweeney refused. "I am confident that my death will do more to smash the British Empire than my release," he stated. "His spirit is as strong as ever," Muriel told the Daily Mail. "I support him in everything." George Lansbury, editor of the left-wing Daily Herald and future leader of the British Labour Party and grandfather to the actress Angela Lansbury, informed throngs of protesters in Trafalgar Square that the Lord Mayor of Cork is currently being murdered in Brixton Prison by the British government. Soon, demonstrators from Brisbane to Boston, Buenos Aires to Barcelona joined in the protest. Yesterday, he was unknown outside of Ireland, reported Madrid's El Sol. Today, the whole world is familiar with his name. In New York, 2,000 longshoremen, including many African Americans, refused to unload British cargo in what became known as the Irish Patriotic Strike. Marcus Garvey, the famed black nationalist leader, conveyed the support of the entire black community to the McSweeney family, while the mayor of New York warned the British government that Terence McSweeney has won the admiration of all the peoples who believe in rule of the people by the people. Letters and telegrams piled high on George V's bureau, beseeching him to intervene. The king favoured clemency, but his prime minister, Lloyd George, was resolute. And so was Terence McSweeney. A surge of shame swept England as 100,000 Corkonians lined the streets of his native city on the eve of All Saints' Day to bid him goodbye. His sacrifice motivated many future revolutionaries, including members of the then-fledgling ANC. McSweeney's biographer Dave Hannigan writes about a young Ho Chi Minh who, working in a London hotel when the death was announced, burst into tears saying, "A country with citizens like that will never surrender." Nehru took inspiration, and it is known that Gandhi treasured his copy of McSweeney's Principles of Freedom, a collection of essays published posthumously. Terence McSweeney lived the heroic role he had written for the protagonist Hugh O'Neill in his play The Revolutionist. Hugh's last words are prescient. "What's the good of being alive if we give in?"
Shema Ezayelemar, Suna Sheni Wara Sain, O Hoi Kema Yelemar. Shaldara Simwai Dene, Anishimwan Trachate Frey.
I rub my left cheek on the left collar of my jacket, of your jacket. And for, oh, a flash of a second, my beloved friend, you are here. Only you're not. No trace of your scent. Your wedding suit dry cleaned, your dust vanished.
On this morning's programme, we heard Runaway by Chris McCallum, The Legend That Is Angela Lansbury by Mary Wall, The Cage of Words by Dermot Bulger, Cabbage Stump Night in Wexford by A.M. Cousins, A Principle of Freedom by Lourdes Mackey, and Blue Suit, a poem by Vincent Woods. This morning's music began with I Want to Go Home by Johnny Cash. Then we heard the theme to Murder, She Wrote, composed by John Addison, played by the Daniel Kane Orchestra. After that, we heard Everybody's Talkin' by Harry Nilsson, then Colcannon by Mary Black and the Black Family, and finally, Muhilamar, performed by Sholin on the Class Act programme on Tigi Cahart. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. For more from this and other RTE Culture programmes, see rte.ie/culture.